And I'm realizing my voice is still very bad, but so it goes.
Is that a reason to take a break and have...
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll just power through it.
Okay. You're just going to steadily decline over the course, and by the end, people are going to be like, is Mark dead?
Yeah.
Is he still okay?
I'm going to sound this way. I've been on the show sounding this way, and we've even talked about it. I'm going to sound this way all the way to March.
Yeah. That's awesome. We brought in the necromancer. We have revived him.
Yeah.
It's good.
Okay. It's that time of year again when your nice hosts take a few weeks off. The program will resume with new episodes in the first week of March or at the end of February for Patreon supporters. But each week until then, your nice hosts will re-air one of our favorite episodes from 2025, along with a few thoughts about each one. This week's nice replay is episode 375, Digital Escape Rooms with Lydia Simchich, originally published November 28th, 2024. I picked this, even though it's 2024, because at the very end of last year... And it was Lydia's first episode.
Yeah.
Yay.
She appeared as a guest before she was dragooned into full-time hosting duties.
So it's like an audition.
Yeah.
Kind of, an unintentional audition.
Yeah.
And it's a good episode on its own. Let's just make that clear.
For that.
But it was also a great introduction for our audience to Lydia. But also, it informed a lot of what we've been talking about recently on the show.
Yeah.
Because you talked about a project you did last year that you repeated this year, and the experience was different.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of like worked through it over the course of a couple of episodes.
True.
So if you've been hearing those and want to, you know, wonder like what the context for all that, this is where it starts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. Lydia, if you remember... A year ago,
yeah.
Is your experience different now? What is your experience like now versus
like
then?
Being on the podcast? Or
yeah. Putting you on the spot, I guess.
Yeah, we're doing the annual performance reviews.
Well, I mean, I am kind of curious if my quality has stayed steady, or if there was a dip with just law of large numbers. You know,
usually I just announce that you get what you paid for.
Fair, which for many is free, but it could be more if you want to give us money on Patreon.
Yeah,
see, she's so good at this. Steve.
Truly, truly.
I don't know if it's any different. To some extent, I think really what is different is just that I have to find little aspects and facets of my day, of what I'm doing day to day. Whereas with this interview, because it was also like retrospective about a project that almost was done, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
It is a lot more different stuff. And sure. So even just like thinking about roundtable topics, I have to think a lot smaller or a lot more abstractly when coming up with those. As opposed, I think the only other episode that I've done that was kind of equivalent in terms of like density and completeness of information was the one where I talked about my experience learning MicroStudio.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was like I had an experience. Let me tell you about the experience in one roundtable topic.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, listeners, you can go back and find that episode as well if you like. But in the meantime, you will hear Lydia free of all of that weight as a guest on the program around this time last year. New episodes resume at the top of March. But of course, if you want to skip ahead 1 week to make the wait a little shorter, you can do that and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus audio that's pretty nice too, at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
We're around a single table in a single place.
Yes.
We do like to get excited about that. And listeners are like, I don't care, it sounds the same.
It sounds the same, yeah.
Yeah,
it's different for us, dear listener.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, but not only are all three of your nice hosts here around the table, our guest is here live in person as well.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Lydia, hi. Welcome to the clubhouse.
Thank you.
Ellen, why don't you introduce Lydia, because you know her very well.
Lydia's great.
Oh, thank you.
Job done.
Good intro.
Okay.
I mean, to be fair, Ellen has talked you up a lot
over the past few
months. Oh, no.
We spent three episodes digging deep into Lydia's backstory. No. In the snippets of Ellen updates that we kind of occasionally talk about, I joined ELB Learning as a game designer coming in from one of the companies that they acquired. And then I... moved on to something else within the company, and that left a big gap in terms of game design brain. And Lydia is the person who has come in to fill that void.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I went to the Women in Games session for IDGA Foundation Twin Cities. I met your wife, mm-hmm. who, and I explained my backstory.
But he was pointing at me.
And said, oh, I think, have you seen Ellen's post? They need a positive impact educational game designer. You should talk to her because she's great. And I was like, oh, cool. And so that's how I found a job.
Yay.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Networking. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do like... There's kind of the dream of community is like when things cross pollinate. So I do like to see when that happens.
Yeah.
And I think from that moment, because Ellen, when Lydia joined, you were like, this lady's great. From that moment, got to get her on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
And now we have. And what Forever For?
Well, so you've been doing a few different projects for ELB Learning since you joined the crew. Mm-hmm. And you've been working on product and you've been working on projects. And one of the projects that you've been working on for the past several months is now, I mean, it's been kind of a weird one. It was like kind of a slow start and then all of a sudden a huge scramble and then kind of a little bit more chill at the end. But you've been working on an escape room for a healthcare association. So... you can give all the background that you want, but it started as a physical escape room and then moved to a digital format.
Yeah. And this was interesting because you had worked on the last year with the same client, previous year's digital escape room, mm-hmm. but not the in-person escape room.
Right.
And that went really, really well. I got to play it. It's really good. Award-winning even,
yeah.
I think.
Ah! It was fun.
Yeah. So it was kind of, it was interesting because... I was going on to this project where you had already met the client, you'd already worked on this sort of thing, but not on the part of the project that was going to be first.
Right.
Yeah. So the last month or so has really been the part that you find more familiar because it's the digital version of the escape room mm-hmm. in storyline.
Yeah.
So not a game engine, but in storyline, this is the first time I've worked with someone with developers building in that.
Yeah. Storyline, just for some background, it's called a rapid authoring tool. So it really is kind of a tool for developing basic interactivity.
Yeah.
Quickly.
Think mm-hmm. about the coolest PowerPoint you've ever seen and then add some steroids to that.
Yeah.
There's a surprising amount that you can do with it, mm-hmm. but it's also some things that are very given and easy to do in game engines, not possible.
Yeah.
Because it acts more like a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah,
sure.
Kind of has, I don't know if any of you will remember, but like HyperCard.
A little bit.
No.
Oh, HyperCard.
Look it up.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't do branching super well.
No.
Okay.
So that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It's like...
even more than like PowerPoint then.
Yeah, yeah. Much more like a PowerPoint.
A lot of it that was... We can talk about that part, but a lot of it was working with the... Alan's title is art director.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's so working with the creative director on... how to mitigate how many variables there are, because if something changes in the room and you go back there, that's a whole other set of variables that you have to deal with and that you have to implement, and that exponentially creates work and creates content that you have to build. It can't say, oh, if you do X, this is no longer here.
Yeah.
That's a very easy Boolean that you could just put anywhere else. Can't do that.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So a lot of it was a lot of that conversation was trying to make sure that we mitigate how many variables and deciding, okay, well, how many continuity errors and what kinds of continuity errors are we okay with because they're not obtrusive and we're just going to build that in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But before I became a video game designer, I, after college, I originally wanted to do, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I started in exploring museums. And I found that I really, really loved exhibit design.
Ooh.
I love collections care. I am not someone who is patient or delicate enough to do collections care every single day of my life.
Sure.
It's awesome. I don't trust myself to do it all the time. But exhibit design was awesome, and I loved that. And so this really got to go back to those roots of, okay, how are we going to build something that could be broken, is going to be dirty? Like, the sheer amount of things that people will touch, even though it seems obvious they shouldn't touch it, the amount of, the creative ways kids can break things. There weren't going to be kids at this conference.
Yeah.
But making sure that it's something that can be handled and broke and like moved and dropped and stuff, all of that harkening back to that experience, as well as trying to fit a lot of stuff in a small space.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like 10 by 10 or something like that.
Not that small, but okay. It was pretty dang small.
It was pretty small.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if we like start with, do we want to give more background on like what the project was about?
You're going to have to lead that because I don't know how much we can give.
Yeah, I can give some. So the organization that we are working with is one that it's an organization of medical professionals. So physicians, nurses, etc. It's like tens of thousands of members around the world. Most of them are in the US, but they have a pretty significant percentage who are international. And because they're a professional association, like what professional associations do is they advocate for their members. So they try to come up with opportunities for networking or for continuous learning and so on and so forth. Oftentimes there will be some sort of, you know, continuing education requirement that people have to meet on an annual basis in order to maintain their license. And that's not just for medical practitioners, but for lots of different industries that require licenses.
And there's also like an information dissemination thing because there's always stuff being improved upon and invented and iterated and researched. And so being able to get some of the word out, either on something that's already existing that you need to learn and specialize in, or just, hey, this is new, more people should know about it. We want to let people know even just a little bit about like a new drug or a new technique or a new standard of care or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's dissemination of information, education, etc. And they also have a big annual conference, right, to bring all this together and to highlight some of that. So what they've been doing, a couple of the things they've been doing is creating like more interactive, more interesting learning experiences that are really short because, you know, doctors and nurses and such are super busy and they don't have a lot of time between patients and so on and so forth. And also, you know, when you're done with the workday, the last thing you want to do is like sit and read a 50-page PowerPoint or like PDF or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, so if there are more interesting ways to that aren't so taxing on your execution capacity.
Yeah.
That's something that they've been exploring too. And one of the things that they've been doing is they've been doing gamification. They have a gamified platform, and then on that they will put little mini games. And so the game that we built last year was the mini game. And then what they wanted us to do this year would eventually become a mini game they would put on their platform, but they wanted to start with this in-person escape room that would be at their conference that people would go through like 6 to 10 people at a time. And so like, you know, it has to have all the, it has to have all the check marks that a short game would have, right? It has to have a compelling like framing. It has to have interesting challenges. It has to be collaborative, but then also like it can't be super long and also has to have a lot of really specific content embedded into it because it does it's about something that's medically relevant, right?
It also has a unique demand of being like a conference like novelty, right? Yeah. Like you go on a show floor, you stand in line to spin a wheel in front of a merch booth for a free t-shirt. It's that kind of thing, kind of, right?
Yeah, it's, yes, but like more helpful.
Right. Well, that's what I mean is that like the audience rolling through is a little bit different than if it's like a seminar you bring everyone to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but then like, yeah, it's voluntary, you know, so it's got to be fun. And yeah, it is supposed to be more meaningful and professionally helpful than like a free t-shirt.
Well, I think also what it more like what your free t-shirt example kind of demonstrates is that this is something that you have to be able to wait in line for and then do quickly before your next scheduled event.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because a conference will have something every hour or multiple things every hour that you're trying to fit into your agenda to make sure that you hit everything before the conference ends because it's only a weekend. And so this can't be an hour thing slotted into that schedule. It has to be short enough that even if you're waiting for it or if you have to leave and come back, you can do it before your next one or before lunch or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a lot of really specific limitations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Makes it really difficult, I imagine, to make a game that fits in that.
And I have a ton of million questions about like the decision-making process towards doing it in this format, but that's on the client side.
Yeah, they kind of came to us with that request up front, right? It's mm-hmm. not something that we talked with them about.
It may have been like, this is a fun idea, or like they may have like thought of all the implications. They may not have.
Well, they've done escape rooms before.
Yeah.
Okay.
They have done. And that was one of the things that we got to see photographs of previous ones. I wanted to just get a sense of puzzles. So they were able to answer some questions. They had all the dimensions already. They were able to give that and give the layout of the room that would be built in. There's actually two rooms running simultaneously next mm-hmm. to each other in a conference.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that until halfway through the design process there's two rooms running simultaneously.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Okay. But that's the other thing is also, unlike real escape rooms where there's someone looking at it, like a facilitator or a game master looking through a camera and then able to give hints, they don't have that infrastructure in a conference room.
Sure.
It's just they build a little room with no ceiling in the middle of a floor. And so as far as like supervision or observation or any of that sort of hint giving, that can't be reliably assumed to have.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they had someone on a ladder.
No. That, I guess, if you're going to do it, standard. It might as well be at a conference of doctors, but...
Yeah. That's
true. Okay, so it kind of needs to be self-sustaining... And like robust and like handle failure gracefully.
Yes,
okay.
And be resettable.
Yeah. Damn. That's interesting. Right. It's like if you are someone who's like, oh, I want to learn to design escape rooms. This seems like a great like crash course.
Yeah.
Like trial by fire for that because it heightens up a lot of the things that escape rooms have just but generally not as much.
Yeah. And it's also it's a nice set of limitations because it asks you to think creatively about your props and your storyline and your puzzle flow, but also it really does make you have to work small.
Yeah.
It's so hard to think small. You can get everything so big, but also then because you've made it small, there are so many things that if we had more time, we would have been able to do in a lot more cooler way. Obviously, there's more detail we could have added or some more fun interactions we could have manufactured. But, that's scope. But having that small format means that you actually could feasibly, if you wanted to do that as your first project, that I think it would work really well.
Hmm. So this is last year's.
No, this is now.
It is not done yet.
No.
Well, okay. The escape room is. The conference
escape room
is over.
Happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think because you started off by saying there was something different about last year's versus this year's.
Yeah, last year's was never intended to be, there was never supposed to be an in-person experience. It was digital from the start and digital only.
Oh, okay.
So the challenge, the extra layer of challenge, for this year, totally different project.
Okay.
Different, partner that our client was working with. So there's like a different source of funding.
And therefore a different topic of content.
Yep, exactly. Different, medical focus.
Mm-hmm.
This one, yeah, they wanted to do the in-person escape room first and then create a digital version of it so that people who weren't able to make it to the conference
right.
or wanted to go through it again or whatever could go and go onto that gamified platform and launch this mini game and then go through this escape room. So
also, effectively, you're like translating. Well, I guess you're translating the digital version of it into a physical version.
Well, I'm certainly not doing any of it.
Right.
It's all Lydia.
Right, Lydia.
Except we did it vice versa. We made the physical version and designed it first. And with mind of it eventually being translated to digital.
Right. Got it.
And so there were things in the design where, I already had an idea of ideally what it would look like in the digital version or how it would work. And then, there were things that, we were limited by the type of props we had, the type of locks we could get, for instance. So, then we'll keep it this in our back pocket of we would really love the code for this particular puzzle to be XYZ. They don't make locks like that. So we'll save that for the digital version and we'll do a close second for the physical version based on the padlocks we could buy.
Right. So rather than letting the physical version immediately constrain your scope, you kept in mind the that was not fully independent of it, but you didn't let it constrain you more than it had to.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So what was the timeline on that? Because the thing that's getting me is like the sort of evolution of this as a concept.
Yeah, same.
So this previous client had an existing thing. They had you guys do a digital version, and then you develop the systems for this sort of work. Then a new client wants it, but also they want a physical version first. So it's kind of like has many parents.
Yeah,
in a sense.
I think it wasn't necessarily parents, but I think it had a very weird history because I could go to Ellen for anything about the digital version because you had that experience of devving for it. And I specifically remember asking you about some of the limitations of storyline while I was designing the physical escape room. So that way I wouldn't make something so I wouldn't have to redesign a puzzle completely because it just physically would not work in storyline.
Right. Oh, my God. I'm so excited. We're like only 17 minutes in and we already got to everything is everything.
Yeah.
Wow, is that a record?
Amazing.
Probably not, but it's a good one.
Yeah. Because you didn't have the precedent with the client of having designed the physical escape room, they designed it with other people, ? There's a bit of that new relationship, like, okay, what are you expecting of me? How have you done this before? Because you've done it before.
Right.
Is my way of doing it going to cause problems? Or how do we approach this communication? And so in that respect, I think that's where there was a little bit of negotiation and just trying to feel each other out.
Yeah.
Because they already had that history of making the in-person escape rooms and like some of that infrastructure. But, you know, and they had a precedent of working with us for the digital stuff, not necessarily for the in-person escape room. So there was some of just trying to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I think the reason I think that the... Last year's game is worth mentioning just to provide the context is because it was like the anchoring experience of the current relationship with the customer, you know, so like various people, the specific project team that was involved in supporting that project was new and working with one another. Many of us hadn't worked with that customer before. You know, we were going for something that was a little more, that was significantly more elevated in terms of its game feel than I think some previous digital experiences had been able to achieve. And so we pushed ourselves to do something pretty awesome. And that set a really high bar, which then Lydia had to then also jump in and navigate.
The thing that was really nice, though, is that having the example of that previous game, immediately my thought was like, oh, this reminds me so much of like the classic point-and-click mystery adventure games. So, like, your Nancy Drews, there was an old Sherlock Holmes game set in a museum or something that I remember playing. There's, you know, that sort of thing. And there's also a certain level of jank to those that lowered the bar in terms of affordances that I had to think about.
Sure.
Because anything where it's like, oh, this is a little bit it's not super sexy, it's not super polished, not got a lot of juice or detail, but it's consistent with the genre. So like if I saw this happening in a Nancy Drew game or if I saw it happening in one of those point and click games, I would totally be like, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or like I've seen this before or yeah, this is acceptable level.
Yeah.
That was always my metric.
It adds flavor. It adds some texture.
Yeah. It feels more genuine. And I don't know how many people actually are going to be looking at this and going, oh yeah, that feels right to the genre.
People actually said that at the awards. They were like, this feels exactly like those games. And I was like,
Okay, cool. Because that's the thing is that was a very centering way of evaluating how high polish it had to be.
Yeah, it kind of is that project established a design language within this context with this customer, with this client that you were then able to lean into when you started working on the puzzles and the digital transformation. So digital translation. Yeah, I'm really glad that first project went well so that you could bounce on it like a little trampoline of
wee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I thought you had a much harder challenge in front of you because of the two-pronged... You had to have two builds of the game that were on completely different platforms, really.
I mean, maybe, but the thing is I had worked in physical space before.
Yeah, okay.
And I basically said, okay, well, we have a one-room escape room for the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
There exist one-room puzzle rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I had remembered, because I watch a lot of Let's Players, I had seen people do one-room puzzle escape rooms before. There are a couple games. I mean, one is called Escape Room Simulator. I watched Northern Lion play it. He's a streamer from Vancouver, Canada.
I've watched him.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's fun.
And then the Game Grumps played a game which was all like one room puzzle rooms where you had to kill the guests at a mansion. At each one, you had to kill the resident staying in that room. And I can't remember the name of it.
We can track it down.
They're
later.
All anthropomorphic. They're all animals, if that helps.
Makes it worse.
Yay. Yeah. we can find the name of that in a bit. But like,
yeah.
So what I did is I remember the project hadn't signed yet. The contract hadn't been signed, but I really wanted to start researching. So I was like, Ellen, I really want to do it. I think in July of this year. And you said, okay, time box it to 8 hours. I think that's all I can really justify having you do before the contract is signed. Mm-hmm. So I was like, cool. And so I did a bunch of research. I started looking at a bunch of those videos, following along and making little flow charts and writing notes about how a little webs of how the puzzles and each piece of information and each puzzle followed into another in those one room puzzle rooms, both in Northern Line and in Game Grumps. I actually found something really interesting. They had the same basic structure.
Okay.
And between, you know, Northern Line being one person and the Game Grumps being two people, mm-hmm. and Northern Line very only once asking chat for help because he was live on Twitch when he was playing it. Despite like the differences in terms of number of brains working on the puzzles, they all were between 15 and 17 minutes long.
Oh, interesting.
Each and every one.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Which was exactly the time that we needed mm-hmm. to make it because we only could bank on people. We had like a hard 20-minute max limit.
Yeah. I mean, for a conference event, that seems actually kind of generous, but also objectively very tight.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It is both. And so I mapped them out and I found, you know, the common blueprint where essentially in one room, there was a obvious track. There was like a obvious one thing to one thing to one thing. Then there was one which I would call looping, where it's like you start on one thing and it gives you something else. So then you have to go to a different puzzle, use that information to solve that puzzle. And then those two things combine to do that. There was there's one where it is not linear, but it is like immediate. You find it and you put it in the lock.
Right.
And then there was a fourth one. I can't remember what it is, but that was the other thing, is that it always had four things combining together to be the final puzzle.
Interesting.
So either it was four keys into like four locks that then open the door, or more usually, four keys to one lock, which then leads to one more puzzle, and then that's what you do.
Right. Yeah. Final boss kind of stuff.
Yeah, but an easier final boss.
Yes,
too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I love easy final bosses. I think we've talked about it on the show before, actually, that's you want to like reward the player by giving them like extra power fantasy rather than like frustrate them after they've just completed all their frustrations.
Plus, there's a time limit in this, so like,
you gotta do it specifically, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is the emotional climax.
Exactly.
You want to feel like you've had the absolute crescendo moment, and you want to feel your most competent.
Yeah,
exactly. Because you want, at that point, that's the moment where you're like, I solved it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're Samus Aran, and you absorbed the energy of the Metroid.
Yes.
And now, whatever alien baddie you're facing down doesn't stand a chance.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So that was what I did in 8 hours before the contract got signed.
Yeah.
So I had a plan. And I very much, and I already, I also, one of the major things from the previous game that I wanted to avoid was that because in the previous game you were walking through a mansion, like you were walking through a old Victorian home, kind of Victorian era mansion.
Yeah.
It was very confusing wandering through those spaces because like going, screen by screen through 3D space, you get lost very easily. You don't know where you are. And that was something that I remember was difficult for the final game, but especially difficult when you were working with the client and another designer and the developers in development. Like, mm-hmm. where does this go? How do we do this? What is the structure of this? And so I also really wanted to lean into taking the one room puzzle room and then making, like, building for that and then having that directly translate into actually two room digital experience. Is I wanted to avoid that problem again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I felt like it would also port a lot cleaner because you can't really simulate multiple locations in one room. I think they've done that in the past and it's been like fine, but it definitely feels like you ported it the other way around if you do that.
Yeah.
And I really wanted it to be one room and there. And I also, because I imagined, like, if you're standing in the middle of the room, navigating the room is you pivot, you pivot, you pivot, you pivot. Oh, eventually you get to the same, like,
yeah,
part. Right. That's a lot easier for you to imagine on a series of screens, mm-hmm, as opposed to moving from one room and then back from one room or turning around in that room. But then which door was it? You know, it gets confusing.
So just to, I wonder if maybe not going into too much detail so we don't talk about the subject matter, but could you talk about, like, the narrative framing that we leaned on? Because I think that there was a really good, like, a really good marriage between the constraints, how you wanted to approach the constraints, and what we talked about early on, the setting should be, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So is it too much of a hint if I say we're, that it's from my home state?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So the conference was held at my home state.
Oh.
And... the client's boss, I think, someone on the client's side, but one of his stakeholders, mm-hmm, brought in. It was one of those, someone's new, someone, it's like someone just joined one meeting and says an idea. Very rarely do you actually get to entertain those, because oftentimes, yeah, they can be derailing or they can be just too big. And yeah, that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
This one, she said, is there any way that we could, like, this is happening in Massachusetts. Is there any way that we could bring some of that in? I was like, yeah, we can. I know that. We can totally do that. And so I did. Like, that was very nice that was the one thing that the you know, kind of higher up person suggested. And it was so actionable to do.
That's great.
And it's also like, I know this area. And so the narrative is your sister, Rose, she is a lighthouse keeper. So the experience begins by her explaining that long time ago, in the late 1700s, during the Revolutionary War, a pirate made a deal with an entity of the sea for essentially control of the weather, control of the seas, in exchange for a price. And so, and then that deal was sealed with a token, which is this amulet that every lighthouse keeper has.
Okay.
So we call it the artifact. The cost is the disease or the ailment that is the topic of the escape room. Mm-hmm. So essentially, long time ago, made a pact. This was a huge boon. He made his wealth. He decided to continue taking advantage of it by building a lighthouse and using it to protect the bay. He died eventually and passed it on. And every lighthouse keeper since has had this artifact, taken advantage of it to keep the bays safe and keep the seas calm around the lighthouse, and also succumb to this illness. So Rose is now in the hospital. And again, because this happened, she's been quite sick. And so she basically, in a letter, explains to you, her sibling, that this is what happens and says, I think that we need to return it to the sea. We need to just give the artifact back now. Now it is time. I can't do it because I'm in the ER. I entrust you to do it. You need to find the pirate Morgaine's treasure, like chest, all the information of where to bring it will be in there if you can get to it. So you're this person's sibling. You go into her home. It's the lighthouse keeper's quarters. And then in the digital, in the IRL escape room, we had locks on a chest, which was pirate Morgaine's chest. And then that opened up the stuff you need for the final puzzle. In the digital room, we got to do what I actually really wish we could have done, but we can't install an extra door and not expect people to break it, is you're in the keeper's quarters. The three locks are on the door to the lighthouse tower.
Sure.
So you get into the lighthouse tower, you're at the base, that's where you find the chest from the pirate Morgaine from the late 1700s. And then you do the final puzzle, you figure out, you find the location where you need to give the, deliver the court, bring the artifact to, and then you return the artifact. And that doesn't cure her of her disease, but essentially, like, means that she doesn't, no one else will have to have this affliction.
Yeah.
So cool. Yeah, that's what you do. So you have to get through three locks in her keeper's quarters, and then you get into the lighthouse itself.
We have a t-shirt.
Wait, yes. What?
No, I knew that.
Yeah, nicegames.club/shirt.
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The people have heard it.
The people, we've talked about this at length.
Yes, uh-huh. Conveniently, it's around holidays, so, you know, if you want to get somebody a t-shirt.
It's still as soft as ever.
It's still very soft.
Still got the logo on it.
But
we have
cool.
We have something new.
Oh.
Mark.
Uh-huh. Wait, this wasn't my idea. I should not be the one to announce it.
Okay, well, I was hugging a pillow, and Lydia, who is here again, was talking about making it into this thing eventually into just a cartridge-shaped thing. But, like, now we have a pillow.
Yeah.
Nice Games Club pillow?
No.
This is the first time I've heard of this.
It is a Nice Games Club pillow.
Okay.
And it is the first time you've heard of this.
Yes.
Because Mark literally just made it.
Okay.
Yep, hit the publish button. And but when this episode comes out, if whoever edits it reminds me, you can go to nicegames.club/merch, which is now the home for multiple things. It's not just the shirt no more.
Okay.
You can still go to nicegames.club/shirt. For nostalgia purposes, take you directly to the shirt, buy the shirt.
Yeah.
But do you want the new pillow? It's a throw pillow. 18 inches on the side.
Ooh.
It's got our cartridge logo, which is different from the logo that's on the shirt.
Yeah.
The one that's in the corner of our website. Okay. Which, Steven, that logo was your idea.
Oh, yeah.
Way back when.
I forgot.
But we haven't put it on anything before other than the website, so that's cool. Maybe we'll put that on a shirt one day. But, you know, we're taking it step by step.
Yep.
New pillow option.
Yeah.
Go to nicegames.club/merch and get a new pillow.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Tell your friends. This is big news.
It is big news.
And I think one of you were saying you don't have to get the shirt and the pillow, but I'm just official policy. You do. You do have to get both.
Yeah, you got to get them both.
You don't have to get them both at the same time.
Right.
You should have both.
We won't be able to police this action, but like those are the rules.
You want to maximize
my pillow's
the power
on the way right now. I didn't actually buy it yet, but
look
I will.
I'm going to go to this URL right now and see how it works.
Look down. Are you wearing a shirt? If no, buy a shirt.
Exactly. Yes.
If yes, you probably need more than one shirt.
Yeah.
Are you taking a nap? If no, buy this pillow. Take a nap.
How's your butt feeling? Is your chair too hard? You should get a pillow.
Yes.
We should have you on for all of these.
Yeah.
I live here. You could.
It's nicegames.club/merch.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Yeah, they wanted originally, they were looking at something kind of Tomb Raider-esque or like Mummy-esque where you have a ancient curse kind of artifact. They wanted that sense of like treasure hunters.
Yeah.
And I brought up that it, even if it is a nondescript tropical island, that's still pretty so one of the first things I brought up in an attempt to try to move away from that very cliche and still kind of problematic but still holding on to the idea of adventure and treasure and can this really be explained kind of question. I was thinking, okay, well, modern treasure hunters, I was thinking a lot about urban explorers, people who like look around abandoned buildings, the fact that there are islands, like there are islands that used to be forts or military bases, or you know, just random rocks in, like, even they have them off the coast of Rhode Island and stuff. Thinking about that, and a lighthouse ended up being one of the things that we thought, okay, that's a structure where someone actually still lives but probably cycled through a lot of history and is something that we can have that kind of abandoned, old, but mysterious thing. And so then having the artifact be something that, you know, she definitely has a modern disease process, as well as the past lighthouse keepers had the same disease. But even if we can't explain it, it's so consistent that it does invite that question of, is it really the artifact? Was it always the artifact? Is it just the environment they lived in? Because there's definitely environmental stressors here. You know, trying to get some of that mystery back in.
Yeah.
I'm very glad that they agreed to it, because I think it turned into something really, really interesting and unique.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of layers to it. And I think you navigated that tension between, like, okay, we have this vision and we want it to feel like this. you really navigated hearing that and being like, okay, so what you want is this kind of experience. Would you be okay stepping away from these specific ways you've described it and going in this direction instead? And they were completely,
they were
really glad that I think you did a really good job.
Yeah. The narrative thing that we had to then extend or be careful about is because we didn't want to do the, like, you find an artifact, you get a curse, you then have to figure out how to return the artifact to stop the curse. We then leaned into something where it's an artifact that then is handed down.
Yeah.
We had to be very careful to not imply that the disease that we were talking about was genetic.
Sure.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was one of the things that we had to refine a fair bit in the narrative and then also in the art and stuff to make it very clear, you know, especially because, like, in the old days, jobs were generational. Mm-hmm. We had to make clear that, okay, no, all of these people had this. They're obviously not related.
Yeah.
And it's therefore, this is not we're not misrepresenting the science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting intersection between different demands.
Yeah.
Right? The story demands a lot of things, the sort of narrative conceits, and what is most interesting to a listener of a story, but then at the same time, it needs to be grounded in, like, the actual lessons you want to teach.
Right.
Yeah. Right? And not fight against that. I mean, a lot of times, if those things are in conflict, you can, as a storyteller, as a designer, you can just pick one.
Yeah.
Right? But in this case, you actually couldn't, there were things you were constrained by, which was essentially reality. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. I think that there were some stories from the source idea that did help a little bit in terms of touchstone of reality.
Yeah.
The one I kept coming back to, just to make myself feel better that it was possible, was the fact that there was the whole idea of the curse of Tutankhamun, where everybody opened up the tomb and then everyone got sick.
Yeah.
And people have been trying to figure out for decades what exactly were they sick with. And it seems like it was was it something to do with the tomb? Was it related to the environment? You know, was it mosquito borne or what? And the fact that it is explainable, but that doesn't stop the power of coincidence.
Yes.
And I think, like, the fact that that's still so emotionally compelling, even though it is figured out,
right?
That or like the curse of Montezuma, the fact, like, it's just traveler's diarrhea, right? Yeah. The fact that that's still, like, a thing we talk about,
right,
and it was so coincidental, but it had a very clear scientific explanation. That doesn't mean, like, just the coincidence and the timing of it made it surreal,
and
fantastical. And so holding on to those examples made it at least seem in the moment as I was trying to figure out that it was going to be able to, we were going to be able to find that middle ground.
Yeah. Did you consider, I mean, the sort of audience of doctors would be familiar with this type of relationship between, knowledge and knowledge receivers, right? So, like, diagnosing patients, having to disabuse them of similar sort of, like, coincidental or, you know, people who are trying, you know, figure out their own diagnosis or whatever. Not necessarily that this audience is all clinicians, but did you consider that in the design, like, as a something to lean into? Like, this audience has special knowledge.
Mm.
Let's leverage that? Or was it just a matter of making sure that you didn't, sort of do something that would, like, essentially be, like, a poor knowledge for that audience?
Yes, but in kind of a way, in a backwards way than I think you're thinking.
Okay.
One of the things that we wanted to emphasize, and actually was part of the content, was that patients tend to underreport their symptoms.
Okay.
And they don't necessarily advocate for their symptoms. And so one of the things that we really emphasized in the diaries of Rose was she keeps saying things like, man, I'm getting old, or like, wow, I'm really getting old, or like, I'm out of shape.
Mm.
And the fact that, you know, if you have a disease that develops over time or is chronic and it lasts a long time, if you're getting worse, people tend to think like, I am getting older, or like, oh man, I'm just really out of shape. They can dismiss a lot.
Sure.
And so, and one of the main things is we needed to emphasize to physicians that this is something that happens. And so really making sure that you're asking the right questions to find out, is there actually something wrong? Something that they're not telling me? And not necessarily maliciously, something that they don't think, realize is actually part of the problem.
Right.
They may be dismissing it. And that happens a lot. And that also, I mean, that happens a lot for women and other minority groups, especially. We tend to just push through and we tend to just, kind of brush things away. But especially when you're thinking about preventative or catching things early or actually like really handling a diagnosis properly and mm-hmm. in the right timeline, you have to be able to suss that out.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but in kind of a weird backwards way.
Yeah. Well, it really makes the sort of notion of the indirect information, right? You're reading the journals of this person, right? Mm-hmm. Like that makes it interesting because that's information that comes to you not directly,
yeah.
which is a skill in through the lens you're describing that yeah. that is important for doctors to be able to understand information that they're not directly told.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating. That like really ties together the sort of the conceit of the narrative, the fantastical elements with the sort of like actual day to day without being a direct,
yeah.
what Ellen always talks about all the time with gamification is like, you can't just give it a different name and call it education, right?
Yeah.
Like, or call it gamification. Like you have to actually like impart it in a way that is if metaphorical or, you know, circumstantial, because the best way to teach something directly is to teach something directly.
Right, right.
So rather than just, you know, put a coat of paint on it, and call it fun.
Yeah, you don't. It should be architectural, not just window dressing.
Yes. Yeah. It's really cool. Yeah, just cool to hear that come out because exactly as Ellen has described it.
Yeah. Like,
I'm not the only one.
I think the one thing that is going to be is a little different than what clinicians will actually be able to do in their office is we got to do a fair bit of show don't tell with the environmental storytelling.
Cool.
So. And this was really cool. So I borrowed an engineer for an emergency playtest because I had to figure out something before bringing some feedback to development between alpha and beta. Yeah, an engineer on the training arcade.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
It was Greg.
Yeah.
He's great. One of the major things that we wanted as part of this is the idea of understanding that people will tend to underrepresent their own or under-advocate for themselves is part of also social determinants of health. So. Yeah. That is fun little initialism that I learned, but that's a lot of like patients who are from certain demographics tend to have different come in and have you have to consider that what they're coming in with. So the fact that, you know, women and minorities will tend to underrepresent their pain, for instance, but also class background. Do they have access to their medications, either physically or monetarily? You know, are their environments clean? Like what are the background forces in their lives, in their individual lives, that affect and influence the type of like how they're going to access care? That's something I think that we were able to show not tell a fair bit that maybe patients wouldn't necessarily tell that we got to do in the game. One of the things being that there were a lot of environmental things that were aggravating this person's illness. We had mouse traps on the floor. We had evidence of cockroaches. We had mold on the walls. Oh. We had estimates for future like mold and guano removal of the lighthouse. One of the things also about this being a lighthouse and an old one is that we could have like demonstrate, wow, when you're staring down a $500 roofing repair, like an emergency roofing repair from the last nor'easter, and on top of that, you're getting estimates for mice removal that didn't work clearly, and guano removal and mold removal. Yeah, your medication might not come first in terms of payment, especially if it is a lot.
Yeah.
And also, we wanted it to be at a lighthouse. They were originally thinking island. We eventually went with like a lighthouse on a peninsula because we wanted being able to go to a specialist or a clinic to be inaccessible. We wanted it to be that the closest thing that they could go to for healthcare was an emergency room. And when you live in a lighthouse, you have to live someplace very far away from people because that's where lighthouses are most useful. And so even just that setting and the remoteness, we were able to do a mix of telling and a mix of showing. Obviously, I don't think people are going to be rolling up to their doctors being like, I have so much to pay for. There's so much bat poop in the lighthouse. There was a vole in my attic. You know, people tend to try to present themselves better than they may actually be when they're at a specialist office.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes a problem. And so that is one thing where I think hopefully being able to see it for themselves will then light up some or bring up some opportunities for doctors to ask or to inquire or to try and feel out what are their living conditions, is that affecting them?
Yeah. And I like too that you're saying that there's the show don't tell of it all, and there's the what the as the sort of character playing the game, you're getting direct information, but then you're exposed to all this indirect information.
Yeah.
That's really useful because then the next time you get some direct information from a patient, you will start imagining what is the information I'm not getting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you have this comparative experience, which is really important. But also, it's really useful in the constraints of this like conference environment
mm-hmm.
where like people who are not like on that level will just go through the puzzles and get it done in 15 minutes. Like the thing is not stopping you to tell you all this. But so there's a little bit of relying on the participant to engage, mm-hmm. but not necessarily holding up the line if they don't.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit, Lydia, about how you brought that, you know, how the design of the in-person escape room tried to capture some of that. Like, what were some of the features and materials that you had everyone use to do those sorts of things? And then how has the process of translating that from the physical to the digital, mm-hmm. how has that been going?
Pretty well. I think we did a pretty good job with the IRL escape room, and the fact that we're keeping it as 1-2 rooms is helping a fair bit. A lot of it is very much in the set dressing. We have little props that we were able to add. So, for example, the Alan, the creative director, when he made the paneling for the inside of the walls to make it look like brick, he made it very clearly there was a whole like swath of mold coming from the ceiling. We were looking at we definitely wanted some faux like roaches. We were thinking about mouse traps. There was some idea of having mouse droppings. I was like, okay, well, if we really probably should make sure that it's attached to something so it doesn't drop on the floor and then the convention people think they have a mouse problem.
Yeah.
So like that was my one caveat, because again, you may not think about that if you don't work in spaces
that have
to be cleaned.
Yeah. Yeah.
But having like plastic roaches in places or having empty mouse traps around, that was really good. We also tried as much as we could, and this is where some of the content was limiting, to have different kinds of written material. Mm-hmm. So we had journal entries from diary, or from Rose's diary. We have medical documentation, different types of medical documentation too. We had, but then also invoices and estimates to essentially, you know, things that I was thinking, if you have a desk and you have a bunch of paperwork and you're frustrated by it, you'd leave it out because you don't know what you're going to do with it.
Yep.
That is something. I know that pain. What would you find? There was something that, I don't know where I heard it, but someone I remember talking about, or they were talking about how they made characters. And one of the things that they did was they tried to imagine what every character had in their trash can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been something I've been thinking a lot about. What do you leave around?
Yeah.
It's like the old adage of, you know, a person by looking through their purse. So we have in her trash can a lot of prescriptions, like used prescriptions and prescription like medication containers.
Yeah.
Like she's going through this like water.
Yeah, that's fair. Are all of these things related to the puzzle? I'm curious if like some of this information might lead players astray.
We tried really hard to make sure it wouldn't.
Okay.
And the thing is, we had to cover so much that it ended up being we had to offload a lot of the content off into these sorts of details.
Sure.
Because otherwise, they would just be sitting there and reading, and that is a really boring escape room.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of the content was on the same theme, but very disparate in, like, the type of information.
Okay.
So, like, the social determinants of health was one puzzle. That was a lot of things. That was estimates and the mouse traps and the pests and the details there. That was all one puzzle.
Yeah, okay.
Another puzzle really focused in on, like, one piece of documentation, which ended up being leading to a combination of five numbers. That was a lot more of medical documentation, different kinds of medical documentation. In terms of distractors, the other thing I learned when I did research was the two types of ways you can have a beneficial distractor is if it is a very obvious red herring. And that can be like this clearly. Usually what it is like faux treasure.
Yeah.
Like you open a chest and it's full of coins. But you can't, you obviously can't do anything with the coins, but you see that there's a piece of a statue, and you're like, that's the thing I need. Who cares about the treasure, right? You throw away the jewels and the coins because you just want this one piece of a pyramid.
Right.
That, or, you know, something that very obviously is just backdrop. Like, this is a lamp. Nothing about the lamp. There's no color coding. There's no letters. Nothing. So those were whenever I was thinking about what is going to do heavy lifting and what is not, I tried to make sure that there was a clear indication and or visual cue that it was part of the puzzle.
Sure.
One of the things we were worried about actually was that in the escape room, you can just bundle all the papers together because you can wander around, grab, get every single piece of paper, and then just shove it into a pile. But each of those pieces of paper is for a different puzzle.
Yeah.
Right.
Even though they relate to the same patient. And so, especially the journal entries, I was really worried people would go, these are from the same book, put them all together, and then they're not going to be able to find the right stuff. They're not going to remember, like, these were on the desk, these were over in the cabinet.
Sure.
So we color-coded them.
Okay.
Color-coded the locks, color-coded any documentation that were related to that puzzle. So then, like, her diary had the same rose stationery, but it was blue, yellow, and purple rose. And then the invoices, the purple was the social determinants of health. So the invoices and the estimates and any like medical documentation that related to that puzzle was also purple. Had like purple logo and header or whatever. So that was also, and we then, of course, if we use that to indicate it was part of the puzzle, we had to make sure that the other things around the room were not the same purple, the same blue, the same yellow.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it didn't end up being a misfire.
So this is a meta element principally for players, but I also imagine it helps with to reset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very true. Much so.
Is that something you had to carry through to the digital version as well, the color coding?
I decided to. Okay. It's not as much of an issue with the digital because you can't, one of the things about Storyline, you can have an inventory system. It does not work the same way that you can make one in Unreal or Unity.
Yeah.
It's okay. More a, this exists in a pocket, and it's just, do you show that it's in your pocket or not? Like, mm-hmm. do you press reveal? And there's so much stuff that what we decided to do is we had you be able to go to the documentation in the room and be able to pull it up and read it, and then you leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
So you always can go back to it. You can always go back to the room and read it. And because it's in one room where you just pivot around, we figured, okay, that is safe enough and that's close enough that it may be a little annoying, but it's not as annoying as having to go across the entire house
right. And
find it again.
Yeah.
Because you can usually pretty much always see it. We decided to do that. And because of that, because they always lived in the same spot and there was no way for you to pick it up, we didn't necessarily have to worry about that. We kept the color coding because all the documents were already, all of the PNG files for those documents were already color coded.
Sure, okay. Yeah. Sure.
So we did add the color coding to the lock just to make sure that especially if they were slightly spread out, that it was just that extra little bit of like, this one belongs to this.
Yeah, it was already incorporated. It wasn't just to solve a particular problem. You then used that as to leverage it into mm-hmm. the design. So the problem didn't exist in the digital version, but it was now part of the design.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's something, I mean, I think if we had started with digital first, that would have been a kind of lift that would not have been as high priority and would have been a nice to have. The fact that it was necessary for the escape room meant that we got to have that little nice to have built in. It was a lot lighter lift. Although apparently it took a long time to figure out how to get the paint splatters to show up on the lock. Just the UVs were not cooperating. It works, but it took way longer than he thought it was going to take. I know. But it was only for the locks, thankfully. Everything else had already been taken care of.
That's good. That's good. Oh, that's funny.
So I'm imagining an alternate scenario where you start with the digital version first and then bring it to an in... Because that would sound like a greater challenge. I suppose with the experience of knowing what, you know, you could imagine, oh, this is going to be a problem on the floor, but you don't necessarily going to know that right away. This wasn't a choice you made which one to do first, but if you had the choice, would you have chosen to do it this way?
I would have still started with the in-person escape room, I think.
Yeah.
Because the power of doing it in digital is you can do so many other cool things because it doesn't have to literally work.
Yeah.
Like, one of the ideas we had for the final puzzle involved reflecting lasers or something to get into the right hole or, like, something to do with light. And just the amount of iteration we would have had to do for that in person to make sure that it didn't result in false positives or false negatives just would have been a lot.
Yeah.
But we can do that in the digital space because we get to say where the laser goes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They can't, we only are letting them rotate or add things so many degrees or so many pieces. I think that it would have been a bummer, because I feel like certain things that we would have gotten really excited about in the digital space, we would have had to cheapen. Sure, or it would have taken so much more thought to make it physically possible. And, you know, there's also an amount of, you know, just what skill do you have? Do you have someone available who can do that kind of manufacturing for an in-person escape room? Or are you relying on pre-made stuff, which is either expensive or not quite, you know, thematically what you want, or mm-hmm. doesn't have the right look or the feel? I think that that would have resulted in a lot more instances where it's like, oh man, that's a bummer, but what can you do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Sure.
Well, there's something to be said for like a grounded experience as well.
Yeah.
And I think that like having an escape room that translates a lot of the physical parts of it into digital says something to players that like this used to be, or it feels a little bit more, well, I said grounded, I think that's the right term, grounded.
it feels
like part of the actual physical world.
Yeah, it more familiar, either literally to the escape room you did in person, or like familiar to something that you actually could expect in the real world.
Yeah, it's more intuitive. The game, interaction with the game becomes more intuitive if it's grounded, like you said, Steven. Yeah.
I've definitely played some point and click games where like you kind of just lose the immersion.
Yeah.
Because it's no longer, you can no longer imagine yourself doing that. But of course, digitally, you can click there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, when that happens, it's very jarring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess, would it be like a useful practice if you were designing a digital-only escape room to kind of imagine those constraints and impose them upon yourself? Because the opposite thing also happened when you did the in-person one first, which is you had to consider the limitations of the development tool.
Yeah.
But it sounded like that you took care of that relatively quickly and made it the adaptations you needed to. But say you were only in the digital space, and say you did have a fully, you know, capable development tool, would you feel a little bit undirected? Like, was those constraints ultimately, like, in terms of the whole package, it definitely was, but imagine there was no real version. Could you imagine there are things you couldn't have done, or did it actually make it a better version to have those constraints?
I think it made it a better version to have those constraints. Yeah. I think what difficulties there would be if we went one way or the other is that it is a lot easier to make puzzles in person, because you very much have the chance to look at the space and go, or look at a bunch of stuff on a table and move them around and mm-hmm. go, what's here?
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. There's also like, you can bring the cipher or the information you need to the lock.
Yeah.
And being able to implement that affordance adds a lot of dev time and adds a lot of scope. And if your tool can't handle it, that's a problem.
Right.
I wonder if puzzle making would have been the one place where I would have felt a lot more free if I had started digitally.
Sure.
I think that's the one thing where I think we did have to think a lot about mental load and working memory. How much are you remembering? I mean, it's pretty traditional for that genre to play with a pad and pen next to you. Do we want to assume that someone will do that? Do we want to assume that we are making it hard enough that that's required? Or are there ways we can do that?
Especially for a 20-minute experience.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was, I feel like that related, and I forgot what the main point was.
Well, you were saying the constraints ultimately improved the product in the end.
Yeah.
But it sounds like there were, it sounded like at the margins there were things it impeded, but holistically you'll take those trade-offs.
Yeah. 100%. I think that it made a better experience. And I think that there's a lot of freedom and you can do anything.
Yeah.
But it's really hard then to figure out what your consistent theme and how you're going to, how you're going to ground it.
Yeah.
What is the theme? What are the languages? What are the premises? What is going to be your given and your space? You have to eventually bound it in, and having to make all of those decisions for me is a lot personally. I like knowing, okay, it's going to be roughly in this space, has to be roughly on this theme, because then I can go, all right, well, let's see you know, we need a certain variety of puzzles. What sorts of stuff would make sense in this room? That's, for me, that's also where why I really like narrative, because it can make it a lot more cohesive, because you can say, oh, yeah, that we could totally have that because it would make sense for her to have this in her house.
Right.
But also, if you're thinking about if you need, like, a bunch of keys, what and do you want to have a lock that is related to the keychain design? Well, where would you keep the keys? My answer is on a hook by the door, because that's where you, like, put your keys either before or end of day. And then what type of keychains will she have? Well, she's in Massachusetts. Let's find a bunch of Massachusetts keychains. And then that then says, okay, well, how many different Massachusetts keychains can I think of that are distinct?
Mm-hmm.
And then that tells you how many distractors or how many possibilities in the room that then you have to follow through. That is a lot better than, all right, I guess it's a star, and then maybe it's a steam engine, and maybe some sushi.
Yeah.
Because you could just do anything. You could just model it or find it in the Unity store, but will it make sense? No, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And you just need, sometimes you just need something there, but if you want to have a sense of, like, okay, this can stay there this way, it's a lot easier to have that solid theme.
Yeah. In order to avoid the panic that comes with everything being everything, you have to put boundaries up so then you can make sense of things.
Well, and you have to, as you've described, you have to sort of stitch it all together.
Yeah.
It can't just be separate components. We've talked about on the show before, like, you know, mechanics versus theme, and, like, the trouble with, like, the board game industry, where those things tend to just live on their own separately and, like, they don't meld together. But when you're forced to work on them both at the same time, you kind of... Like, it's just a natural process, right? It's not something you need to force yourself to do necessarily.
And it sounds like what I did also try to find some documentation on designers and developers of escape rooms. And one of the things that I remember reading that was very much on this theme is they said, choose your puzzles and your set pieces on the theme of your escape room. If you're in Dracula's castle, there's probably not going to be a QR code scanner.
Right.
So, like, but if you have a bunch of QR code puzzles, that might make sense for, like, a CEO's penthouse suite.
Mm.
But, and so then it's that, just thinking about, okay, well, what locks are going to be in a CEO's suite versus in Dracula's castle? We're going big, chunky metal locks for Dracula, maybe some combination locks. But then as far as the CEO, like a retina scanner or a fingerprint scanner or like some form of code or a safe or a wall safe behind a picture, maybe Dracula has that too, but they're going to look like different safes.
Yeah. Right.
That also tells you if you're going to do, if you want to have like a combination puzzle, that then tells you what that lock is going, you have a better sense of what that lock's going to be.
Yeah. Right, right. It also allows you to communicate with ironies. So if you have the retinal scanner, in like behind a bookcase in Dracula's castle, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And that means something now.
Yeah.
What does it mean? What does it mean?
That means, like, you know, it just, if you've lived for a long time, you have your favorite things, but then you might get that one piece of technology that you're super, super into.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Dracula loves his old school locks, but is really into Samsung Galaxy phones.
I feel like he would probably be really down with 3D printing because he doesn't have to worry about ventilation. And he could make all his favorite Victorian things that died long ago because and were forgotten to time. If he can make the 3D file, he can print his new versions of those.
Yeah, but then they're like weird little plastic versions of it. And I kind of love the idea of just Dracula. We have to make another game.
Yeah,
we have now Dracula's in the Blender.
Yeah,
I still haven't done a game jam. Got to do that today.
Global game jam's coming up.
Coming up.
Yeah.
You don't know what game you're going to make, and you don't know what the theme's going to be, but it's going to be Dracula, and it's going to have 3D printing.
Well, we also have that horror game about which makes use of like automatic lighting and stuff that we talked about last time we met in person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many games to make.
Mm-hmm.
So many jobs.
Invite me to Game Jam.
Game Jam.
Please.
Well, we're going to record one more episode today. Do you want to make it a nice Games Jam, and would you like to join us?
That'd be fun.
All right. Let's do it.
Yeah!
Listener, tune in next week. Lydia's going to design a game with us. Great.
Yay.
Exciting.
It's happening.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I mean, before we get to all of that, thanks for coming on. It's great to see. It's good to have you here in the clubhouse. And man, so much to chew on, I think.
Yeah.
We've been on this like puzzle tear in our interview episodes lately.
Yeah, yeah, puzzles are great. Yes. I love puzzles.
And this is like, this is feels like a piece of that that we've been missing up to now. Yeah. So it's really good.
Yeah.
I hope, I suspect listeners will get a lot from it.
Yeah. I think it's a rare project that gives us like the opportunity as designers to do what you're doing. So yeah. Thanks for sharing your experience, and I'm really excited to. There's a build I can play now.
I know
you guys can't play it.
It doesn't have any critical bugs anymore.
Yay! Milestone high five. Okay, that's our show. You can find Lydia online on LinkedIn. For show notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Threads at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and becoming John Cena. Interesting. I haven't seen Dale in a while. Okay. reply there on Threads or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, well, we're going to be doing a game jam, so tune in. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.